Welcome back. You're listening to A Woman's World. I'm Purvi Shah, and today I have with me clinical doctor and health professional Rupa Patel. We've just been talking about her work in rural sites in Bangladesh. And Rupa, you said that you also had a second story, right, that you wanted to share that encapsulated your experience. What was that?
I think the second story gives the example of, like, holistic care. And I think that's very important because I think medicine nowadays, as someone that's still in academia, now when we're at the bedside, we are trying to teach our students, you know, medical students, etc., about social care services, asking about domestic violence, making sure the patient is linked with mental health services. I mean, the whole genre, because someone's not going to take their meds if they're truly depressed, and we have to find out what's going on, and is that because, like, their son or their husband is hurting them, or et cetera, et cetera. And I practice HIV, so I've seen many links where mental health plays a role, and then social situations. So
wait, let me actually, before you get to the story, because you just said something really powerful. You said that you work with HIV, and you've seen these situations where the links are really made transparent to you. Can you talk a little bit more about that? What do you mean?
Like, for example, I had a example of a patient who, you know, newly found out she was HIV positive, and she wasn't, you know, responding to my phone calls, coming to the clinic, and taking her meds as much. So I called her, and had her come one time. And I said, what's going on? Something is deeper than this. And she's like, you know, I don't feel safe in my home. And I go, why don't you feel safe in your home? And she goes, you know, I live with my 18-year-old son, and he's just become violent a little bit. You know, and so when someone has that fear of just basic living, then, I mean, the whole dynamics change. So, you know, it wasn't about her meds. It was about getting her to social services, getting her into a different house, getting her to just be comfortable and safe as a human being, and then let's talk about all the other stuff.
That's really powerful, because I think, and you started talking a little bit about holistic medicine, and I want to talk more on that, because, you know, nowadays it seems like Ayurveda and a lot of the, you know, acupuncture and Eastern systems of sort of healthcare have become part of the U.S. and Western world practice. But it feels like it's still kind of not the norm in terms of care here. I mean, how have you perceived that in terms of current healthcare work in the United States?
Well, I see a patient population that's more educated on kind of these Eastern philosophies, herbal supplementation, Ayurvedic. I've gone to the yoga ashram, and I've gone to, like, an Ayurvedic kind of ashram, and I wanted to see if my symptoms would work for autoimmune disease or something of that nature. So I've definitely seen, actually, to be quite honest, a more patient kind of, you know, just spearheaded movement, if you would say.
That's
where
amazing.
They ask me about these things. I think it's hard from a professional standpoint because, you know, there's things about legality, like FDA approved X and Y and Z. And, you know, I think it has to be the philosophy of your doctor, you know. And I think there's more philosophies about preventive medicine, alternative medicine, like medicine that's going to, you know, make you feel better with your body. And I think there's that sync that now doctors are recognizing in this kind of new teaching and new media of, you know, there are other solutions. So, I mean, the first thing I tell someone for something simple like constipation is do X, Y, and Z. Don't run for, like, the, you know, super strong prescription laxative, you know?
Wait, so when you say X, Y, and Z, what is X, Y, and Z?
Like, eat more fiber, you know? Like, you know,
not that you're giving medical advice here, but
yeah, like, I mean, try something that you feel like would be better for you over the counter, like, do lifestyle and diet modification. That's for everything, for diabetes, for, you know, cardiovascular disease. We're trying to do more other diet, lifestyle, preventative modifications of disease or preventing of disease.
Yeah, that's It's so incredible that both patients are spearheading, you know, this questioning of other ways, but also, I mean, I think what's really powerful as a provider, you suggesting that there needs to be habitual changes, you know, that, I mean, that's really powerful because I think so often we've been trained that, oh, this drug will fix it, when really, like, it is deeper.
It's a philosophy, and you just have to find the provider that, I'm a minimalist, you know, I just... polypharmacy is ridiculous nowadays. Like, people are coming in with being on 20 different medications, and you know, being on all those medications has its own effect. And so I try to do, but that's my philosophy of medicine, and then that philosophy has to be, like, shared with the patient. Does the patient agree? And then you come up with your own kind of solution to some of these diseases.
That's great. I don't want to leave our listeners in suspense. What is your second story?
The other story was very powerful to me, and it actually kept me back in Bangladesh for like 6 months, and then now for 3 years of what I'm doing in my work. And I had a woman that came in and said, she was 17, and I'm in rural Bangladesh. And she came in into this room that we had devised where we, you know, we close the windows and we have curtains so no other people can, you know, peer in. And, you know, we keep the door locked, or not locked, but we have the door shut and we have a curtain. And so that even when somebody by accident comes in to ask a question, you know, they still can't see anything in this room. Well, what was very important is this woman, she, you know, she had a skin rash below her belt. And in her genital area. And, you know, we asked a few questions and she basically said she had been married, but then she spent the night with her husband just once. And then her husband left and then she, you know, moved back into her own home, her parents' home, but actually the home of her uncle. And so, you know, just by that, you know, I was treating her for STDs because I didn't know where else this man that then gave her the lock had been anywhere. And she clearly had said this man had, you know, needed the dowry. So he married her and then she thinks he's left because she hasn't heard from him for 7 to 8 months. And then she knows that there was some talk of a talaq and then she had to move back. And so the bottom line was, I said, you need to come back in a week because we need to, like, follow up on some of your treatments. And she goes, can I come back in 2 days? And, you know, I was the clinician. I was like, sure, whatever you want to do. And she goes, I just want to come and sit. And, you know, I at that point I realized, like, it was just a room about being loved. It was just a room about having someone to share your story or just to see a smile. It was a room that, you know, I wanted to bring mental health services for these women that, like, may be in depression, may have gone through rape. So, you know, domestic violence, like other sexual violence. So what I'm saying is those things don't exist. And unfortunately, or fortunately, as a first-time provider, unfortunately, because sometimes you don't have services, but that the whole, you know, you open up a whole can of worms. And so when I go to Bangladesh and I try to create a woman's place, a woman's room, it's so much more important for me. It's making the safe place where women can just relax and, like, just feel at ease. That's it.
That's incredible because I think it's so poignantly true for the context you're talking about. But I feel like that safety of space is true wherever you are, whenever you're accessing health services. I mean, we have all these conversations about medical providers and bedside manner and how, you know, people do or don't have it. And, you know, I don't think we get to hear enough about how that can actually make a difference in terms of what you share with your medical provider. I mean, have you noticed that these kind of really deliberate ways of setting up the way you are giving services make a difference in terms of what people share?
I definitely think if you're coming through a busy ER, I also do some work in the ER or the urgent care in the Veterans Affairs Hospital. And I think it's amazing the strides they have taken to make the place a warmer place for veteran women.
Mm.
You know, our screens now say that we, you know, you must do like a homeless check. You must do a domestic violence check.
Mm.
You must do an other violence check, making sure that they have their GYN preventive care and all these things. And so going back to your question, I think it depends on the setting you're coming into. If you're coming into a busy ER, I think things are overlooked. I'm not saying that it happens all the time, but it can be because of the circumstances. And then you're talking to a woman that's a provider. And so, you know, I see the women that hopefully are getting the care, you know, like I'm giving them that care. So, I mean, they're my patients. So I may hear a story before that. But I also do a lot of, you know, I do HIV medicine. So I see a lot of women that actually, maybe I'm their first provider because they're referred to me.
Hmm.
So, I would just say it's the settings that you put yourself, you know, that the patients come in.
So I know HIV, has been a part of particularly infectious disease work in the States for a while, but how did you decide that you wanted to have that be a part of your regular clinical practice?
I think it's because HIV, I've always been interested in the whole public health, social aspects of medicine too. And I just really knew that HIV had this whole stigma associated with it. And so when I saw the newly diagnosed, you know, immigrant woman,
mm.
I practiced in Texas for a little bit where I did my training. And, you know, the newly diagnosed immigrant woman from Mexico, it was so much more than just HIV. It was like being shunned from her family. It was social support. I would have patients come to my clinic every month to 2 to 3 weeks, not to do anything with their medical work. It was just like, how are you doing? How are you handling this? Like, do we need to get you into social services? Like, what do you want me to link you to a support group? Like, how are you doing with this diagnosis? It's devastating.
Mm.
I mean, from a social ostracization standpoint.
Wow. I mean, all of this sounds so overwhelming. Have you had experiences where you felt like you had patients that showed remarkable resilience, or you felt really amazed by how much they could endure?
Most doctors, we have stories, and I was lucky enough to have stories of patients that inspired me very young. And I think one example is during my training very early, where I had to, you know, 1 to 2 years before I had to choose my specialty, I encountered patients that, for unforeseen reasons, just had acquired HIV, you know, through sexual encounters. And it's bad luck because no one can guesstimate this. And, you know, unfortunately then they had to live with that lifelong disease. And the way they approached my clinic was, you know, doc, I need to get on these medicines so I can conquer the world. You know, I need to be the marathon runner. We need to get me back to, you know, I'm running. I'm going to be the engineer. I'm going to finish school. And, you know, it was so important to me to support them and to make sure from a medical standpoint and a mental health standpoint and just a comfortability overall societal standpoint that they were going to do what they were destined to do, and that was advocate for, you know, HIV prevention, some of these guys, or they wanted to do their other things in their careers. And, you know, I really wanted to be a part of this young population that had this breath of energy.
Mm, that's amazing. Hmm, that's amazing. And partly what you're talking about, too, it seems like in terms of the community you're describing, it seems to be about a population of young gay men, right, that you encountered in this. And, you know, oftentimes we think only of this disease as, you know, that kind of conversation. But obviously you're saying it's partly that, and also women who acquire HIV/AIDS from partners as well. So, you know, there is so much complexity, but I love this example of resilience and how it inspired you to help, you know, support to make dreams come true in that way. We're going to take a short commercial break right now and go back to some of your more recent research and work, which actually ties right into what we've just been talking about. So thank you for listening in, and we'll be right back after this short commercial break.